Frequency Cast Special Report. Startup in progress.
Hi, this is Pete.
And this is Carl from Frequency Cast, the UK's TV and technology podcast. This is a special report recorded in November 2011, where Pete was invited to take part in an industry insight session discussing the future of the internet. So Pete, what is the future of the internet all about?
Well, you're about to find out. For our December edition of Frequency Cast, we summarised some of the discussions and we interviewed some of the attendees. We recorded the entire session and thought that our listeners might want to hear the session in its entirety. You can find out more information about what we got up to, plus our interviews, at frequencycast.co.uk/plusnet.
We're about to play you the full audio from that session. The recording lasts for just over an hour. Apologies in advance, but the quality of the recording isn't great, so we've tried to clean it up a little for you. But you should be able to make out what's being said.
The session was chaired by Matt Warman, who's the Consumer Technology Editor for the Daily Telegraph, and attending were members of the PlusNet DigiCare team, the editor of Web User magazine, a technology blogger, and a PlusNet super user. We started off with a quick round the table to see who everyone was.
My name's Ken Lowe. I'm a freelance writer and I'm a blogger as well. I mainly blog about mobile technology and mobile broadband, actually. But I'm interested in kind of things like how smartphones and tablets are changing the way we use the internet, also video on demand and some of the effects that will have on the internet.
Okay, I'm Daniel Booth. I'm editor of Web User magazine. Web User is a consumer-facing internet magazine, which is concerned about how the internet can be used more easily, more quickly by the average guy who loves the internet and uses it on a regular basis. And so, in that regard, things like net neutrality and traffic management are important for our readers. They care to a certain degree about some things, less about others. I think they're more concerned about how it affects them practically than the theory of it.
I'm Bob Pullen. I work for PlusNet in their digital care team. It's basically a small team, but we're pretty much sort of the vocal front of PlusNet. We're out there across sort of the social media channels, in our own community forums, and we kind of maintain the feedback loop between what's happening internally across the business and what our customers and prospective customers and perhaps ex-customers might be saying about us. I do follow sort of things and movements across the industry quite closely. Your own blog, Daniel, your Twitter feeds and things like that. I keep tabs with that sort of stuff as well. So, yeah, I do share quite a lot of interest in it, and I work quite closely specifically with the networking guys and the network operation folk internally. So I've got quite a broad top level knowledge of traffic management, net neutrality, and issues such as that.
My name's Ben Trimble. I work in the quality and service management team at PlusNet. Our team looks after a number of platforms, but obviously the one relevant today is the broadband platform. So on a daily basis, I'll be checking the network, making sure everything's performing as required, and working very closely with the people who monitor these things and order all the extra bandwidth and make all the decisions about how our platform is built and scaled. But my background has been in customer support, so from 3 years, speaking directly to customers, working through a variety of things from technical support through to finding resolution teams. So I've got a good background there on actually speaking to customers and educating them.
Hi, I'm Barry Zubel. I'm referred to as a PlusNet super user. I've actually been affiliated with PlusNet for about 8 years. I was a community forum moderator for them for 4 years. I'm here to help them, poke them, and see what response they can give to your question.
The topics discussed had largely been suggested by listeners of Frequency Cast, thanks to those who emailed and tweeted us with your questions.
The first item on the agenda, introduced by Matt, was to get a feel for what's driving internet demand.
I guess sort of the most obvious thing to talk about is the very practical side of what's actually driving the massive increase in demand on broadband generally and PlusNet in particular. And I wonder whether you guys see any difference in sort of what your users demand versus what the overall market generally demands, but also whether it's what the breakdown is between TV, tablets, phones, that sort of thing. It probably makes sense to start with your perspective and then come back from our side. Where are we now and where are we headed?
I don't think it's any secret that sort of streaming applications and services are pretty much at the forefront of driving usage and demand. Things like YouTube, iPlayer, in particular, I saw reference in the agenda, Netflix and things like that, they're up and coming, Xboxes, TV services, UView early next year. And I think that's only going to increase usage even further than it is. So I don't think our particular perspective or what we see across our network is too much different to what other people are reporting across the industry, other ISPs and content providers as well. I think at the moment, Ben will probably correct me if I'm wrong, but especially at peak times when we're looking at the bandwidth across our network, there's more than half of that, more than 50% of that is being driven by streaming applications, primarily split between iPlayer, YouTube and Sky Go as well, which perhaps not as much as the others, but that's increasing. We have seen an increase with that as well. So I don't think what we see is particularly different to what everyone else sees across the industry. It seems to mirror the kind of reports you see elsewhere. The smartphone and sort of internet tablet discussion is quite an interesting one, because I don't think we can particularly differentiate between what traffic on our network is smartphone driven or driven by tablet use. But I would imagine a reasonable degree of that is going to be more streaming based, especially as more devices support that form of media streaming. I think recently seen a statistic based on US traffic, Sandvine, a traffic management hardware company, do a lot of analytics themselves. I think they reported that across the US traffic in general, they were seeing well over half of that being non-PC use. So again, that's probably going to be broken down to console stuff that's being driven, tablet, smartphone use, rather than your typical laptop and desktop environment.
What about gaming as well?
I don't think we've seen, Ben, we've seen increases in gaming. I know, obviously, that OnLive has been a recently introduced service, and that's recently hit in excess, I think, of a million subscribers. This side of the pond, which is interesting considering how long it's been out for. And I think that's going to, coming with that, it will be quite interesting, because typically gaming traffic has been pretty low volume, but latency sensitive type stuff, whereas OnLive kind of brings to the mix, it's quite high, it's high bandwidth, it's bandwidth intensive, as opposed to it being, you know, having a meg stream that's going to cater for something like that. You're looking for perhaps 5 meg continuous streams to play that content. So maintaining that high bandwidth and keeping the latency sensitive side of things, keeping on top of that, it'll be an interesting challenge depending on how it pans out.
Ken, Dave, does all of that, is that in line with what you would expect, pretty much?
I think so. Streaming is probably what our readers spend, in terms of video, multimedia content online, is probably what they do most of. YouTube, iPlayer, I think, dominates the TV on demand arena. Netflix will be really interesting next year, seeing how that impacts upon people like Love Film, and whether Love Film streaming share takes a hit. Our readers are an interesting bunch. I think they obviously want fast, reliable, flawless streaming. But on the other hand, they also question the need for things like 100 meg broadband. So there's an interesting schism, really, between what they want and what they think they're capable of consuming. We asked them recently what their average data usage was for a month. And they tend to run about 20 meg a month in terms of download capability and download usage. Not many of them really on unlimited packages. Most of them do have a limited amount that they can't go beyond without incurring fees.
Which is interesting. I think Ofcom, recently Ofcom published their average usage around that 17 gig mark.
That's what prompted the question, yeah. So gig number, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think most of them were around that. Even these are people who love the internet and use it regularly, and for them it's an obsession and passion and a daily hobby. They still don't always go over that kind of average.
Sure. I think compared to ours, even that's the 17 gig with Ofcom, our average use across our base on the last check, which was reasonably recently, and that was at 13 gig, so that's...
Yeah.
Compared to the 17 gig that Ofcom...
I think the 17 gig surprised an awful lot of people by being quite so hard, didn't it? Do you have any ideas why they might have come up with something higher than what even you guys see?
I suppose a lot of our particular product offerings, especially the vast bulk of our attrition's from the guys who are coming in at the entry level, the value products, which are do have usage limits, which are relatively low at the entry level point and get quite moderate to the middle sized packages. So I'd say our user base is perhaps skewed towards maybe the lower end user, rather than some of the sort of eat or you can broadband providers, the guys.
If you want to watch 8 hours of film a day, or you've got a teenage son who's playing games for 5 hours, you're going to have to go with Virgin Media, really, or BT Infinity or something, and that's the kind of package you're going to have to take advantage of.
Absolutely. So I think Ofcom may well be, it may be a slightly more accurate, perhaps industry-wide figure of 17, but even the 13 across ours, looking back at historical averages, I think that's a couple of years ago, that would have surprised us.
It's probably worth touching on fibre, given that that's one of PlusNet's natural steps towards that kind of area. You know, because not everybody wants a package. There are a lot of people out there who do just want kind of, you know, internet, and then they might use Freeview or something. So, definitely.
Just so interesting, like, in terms of, do you see there being perhaps a problem in the future where, people will start to use things like UVU when they come up, and most people probably don't even know what the downloaded allowance on their package is, and they'll start using this, and I don't know if they automatically get charged for going over limit or they get blocked off at a certain point or something. But I mean, I found in the mobile industry, mobile broadband, you know, people are starting to use more apps and stuff, and they don't realise, and they're suddenly hitting their limits maybe a few months into their contract, 12 months in, and they've still got another 12 months to go. I mean, is that potentially going to be a problem as well for
We'll start seeing that a lot more. I completely agree with what you said there. I think from an actual customer perspective, it's a little bit more forgiving, I think, logo about things compared to, you mentioned mobile use, and I think this month, for probably the first time ever, I've come extremely close to my data allowance. A couple of months back, I exceeded it. I didn't get a great deal of warning about it, to be honest. I went over it. I didn't make a huge additional fees, but there was a bit of extra charging on at the end of my monthly bill. With any of our media products, you ask whether or not you'd get charged, or we'd restrict you or stop the service. It's down to the user, to be honest. By default, it would do step charging as they hit a bandwidth allowance, but we warn them well in advance, sort of kind of 80% before they hit that allowance, as they're approaching it again, and then at each step that they would levy further charges, they'll have further email notifications. The other option that we give them is to kind of just stick it at a hard limit. We won't completely turn the service off then, but it will be rate limited quite heavily. But it will be usable for browsing, for email, for things like that. But if it came to sort of streaming any reasonably heavy content or downloading anything over a peer-to-peer service or anything that's bandwidth intensive, they wouldn't be able to do it. They'd hit their next billing day, that would then get reset. Yeah. They're always free to switch between the offerings we've got anyway. So the 12-month contract thing's kind of, it's not as void. They'd have to pay us more, understood, but they can switch between the offerings.
I think for a lot of people, they kind of think, well, you know, I've paid for this broadband connection, now suddenly I can't use it, and they do blame the ISPs or they blame the operators, you know, for, you know, not being able to use it anymore. And people don't understand data limits. Like, they don't know, like, you know, if you're listening to this radio stream, you use twice as much data as this one because the bit rate is twice as much, and often you can't tell the difference when you're listening. And you know, using this app that uses a lot more data than this app, people don't understand how much data is being used by different applications, different, you know, does video use a lot more than audio? People don't really understand that, and
this is why
I think that's going to be a problem that ISPs might run into.
This is why I make it very easy for our customers to actually check up on this. You can log into our website, and you can actually use a section where it has your broadband usage. That's accurate within about 2 hours. And it breaks it down into different protocols as best as we can identify them. So you can see if your stream is taking up a large proportion of your usage, and then you can look at it day by day to see where you're getting high usage per month.
There's also loads of free programs online you can use to monitor your, not just your broadband speeds, but also your data usage.
I mean, I understand for technical users, but for the normal users, for families and people like that, maybe that's just something that they struggle with.
I think it is an interesting question, because typically, and I think we probably will get to talking about it later on in this session, it's always been quite a challenge to educate people about speed. And I think you're completely right. You're probably going to find that that's going to switch more from trying to educate them about necessarily the speed and what the usage and the content consumption and sort of what bandwidth allowance they're going to need to satisfy what it is they want to do.
And I think there are companies looking at sort of McAfee style, not this is a virus on your system, but you're about to hit this much, using twice as much.
There's certain programs that send you email alerts.
Yeah, exactly.
You're about to, but it's an invisible thing. You know, there's no precedent for the average family when they're consuming this kind of data. You can watch any kind of TV program you want. You're not limited to 100 programs a month. You're not limited to 100 phone calls a month. So if you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, and you've grown up with the consumption of mass media, it's very difficult to kind of make that conceptual leap to something which is going to be limited, or you're going to get charged if you go over a certain amount.
Yeah, absolutely. Is this, where does this put you in terms of your network? Is this, are you straining at the seams?
No, not at all. I think there's always been quite a strong focus in PlusNet on usage and network. You may have seen some of the blogs we've published before that we've picked up on particular events that may have happened that have driven usage across the platform. I'd like to think that we accommodate quite well for that. We've been at it a while, and we've kind of stuck to a similar sort of business model rather than it being all you can eat. We've sort of driven usage-based products and things along those lines. I think at the moment, as things stand, and obviously we are seeing increases in usage, we're very rarely, if ever, hitting two-thirds of the sort of top-level capacity across the network. And even that in itself is set over the coming months to pretty much double. There's a lot of things obviously happening next year that I think are going to drive things like the Olympics. We've already mentioned YouView, Netflix and the other streaming services. So I think we're in a good place as far as that's concerned. We've been monitoring it for some time in excess of the last sort of 18 months and beyond, so we can kind of plot expected usage. Obviously nobody knows exactly what's going to happen over the next 12 months, but I'd like to think we're in a reasonably good place.
Although presumably that's costing you a decent amount of money. Is that something that you think in this industry you've just got to absorb, or is that something that's going to get passed on to consumers, or what?
That part of it is all about correct management of it. Just the way that the bandwidth is charged to ISPs, if you have a good history of monitoring upcoming events, planning and predicting usage trends well, then you can keep within contracted bandwidth to make sure that you have a very smooth usage curve. It's only if you start seeing large spikes and go into and out of your contracted bandwidth with your wholesale provider do the costs then become excessive. So it's all about constant monitoring and just making sure everything stays within sensible limits, and then that's how you can run a cost-effective business.
Does that mean consumers are fair? If you do your job, consumers are fairly well insulated?
Well, exactly. Once your company reaches a certain size, then small events don't have, medium-sized events don't have any knock-on effect to your customers, and we can happily run, carry on the business like that, so that the customers receive a completely fair and consistent price.
Although the trend obviously is for massively increased usage and more costs, more.
We always keep an eye on the trends in usage, and they are predicted well in advance, and all the price points of the products, they're set again in advance. So if we come to seeing higher usage become the norm, then we'll look at the product offering to make sure that the people who want that are catered for, whereas those who don't want to go crazy with the usage, the people happy with just standard web browsing, we always make sure that they have an offering that's suitable for them as well.
Apparently, is it? Super user, is that the pattern that you've seen as you've needed more than it's always been available? But
yeah, I mean, a few years ago there were some issues and there were problems with actually delivering enough bandwidth, I think you'll agree. But certainly in the recent 2 or 3 years, there's always been enough for everyone. And I mean, as Bob said, they're hitting two thirds of your available capacity, and they're always increasing. I mean, you blog regularly that you've increased each of the MSILs coming in, so they're very, very aware of what's needed. They're aware of how much is being used, and yeah, I mean, there's always enough available for all the users.
Next week we've got the next lot.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's a similar announcement.
Friday.
Is it Friday?
Friday. Well, to put it into perspective, I think it's okay to tell you the figure that we're putting in half a gigabit per second on Friday. That's a standard amount for us. Probably the lower monthly bandwidth increases. And we regularly put that out to customers on our website as well. And we'll explain how much bandwidth is going where and just keep an eye on everything that way.
And presumably that's driven, as you say, by streaming, but a fair chunk of that is planning for the future, isn't it? Do you have any sense of what the spike is going to look like for next year with the Olympics, with all that sort of thing?
Ben's probably best suited to look at that. I think he's probably analysed or looked at side more graphs than I have, but yeah, I'm sure we've got an idea as to where we expect things to go.
Yeah, I mean, you've got two different things you're looking at. You've got the general increase in streaming services, things like YouTube, iPlayer. They are regularly increasing on a week by week basis. We regularly see them, breaking their own previous bests, as it were. You then also have the one-off events, things like the Manchester United versus Man City game. A lot of people happen to watch that because they may only have access to Sky Go if someone else was hogging the TV or if there was some reason why they weren't watching it at home. So you need to always keep in mind the general increase and the one-off events and just make sure that you're covered for both of those. Mm. And we are bringing forward the bandwidth that would have been allocated in 2013 and through to 2012 to make sure that we do have sufficient bandwidth. So we're running at two-thirds, as Bob said, at the moment, and then we are actually doubling the overall capacity for next year so that we are covered for any large events that may happen, no matter what the source.
Do you think more people will watch the Olympics online than, say, the World Cup in 2010? Mm.
I think the main difference with the Olympics compared to the World Cup is the number of concurrent events.
Okay.
So we're looking at the high 20s, the number of concurrent streamed events.
Right.
And the BBC will be streaming those variable bit rates up to high def.
Sure.
So it's a very different picture compared to a single match.
But might you not get, say, 20 million wanting to watch England at football in the World Cup, but with the Olympics it's more 50 times 100,000.
Well, if you look at the demographics of it, people may prefer to watch football with friends at home, sitting on the sofa with the kids, or meeting in the pub with friends, whereas the Olympics, I don't think that'll probably have the same sort of effect. So people may turn more online for the Olympics, especially when they'll be able to choose the particular events that they may be interested in, which may not be broadcast on normal, on the standard BBC channels.
Also, I assume with the Olympics, we're talking about short bursts of activity. Yeah. 10 seconds for the 100 metres or in a couple of minutes either side. It's not...
I think it's going to be sort of event dependent quite a lot. I think we saw quite a bit of a spike with the Usain Bolt stuff, I think, for the 100 metres.
Okay.
There was visible spikes on the network.
Yeah.
There. But personally, it could either be a huge amount of bandwidth or people might not watch it. It's a really hard one to call, I think.
This is a hostage to fortune here. But I'd be surprised if a lot of people actually going to be that bothered.
I think what
apart from the real standout events, I don't think anyone's going to want to watch archery live.
What we've seen, especially with Wimbledon and things like that a lot in the past, is a lot of the usage from the events comes in the day. And you find that it's businesses who might want to chuck the games on their plasma screens or things like that. So they might not be actively watching it.
Mm-hmm.
But you do see quite a marked increase in the actual day. And a lot of the time, and a lot of the forecasts that we do, we structure that around our peak time usage.
Yeah.
Sparing a lot less thought to what happens in the day, because typically you've always got more than enough.
It's interesting, because most big events are going to be in the evening, and 100 metres is on a Saturday.
Mm.
So I just wonder, I do wonder what people are going to be watching during midweek. I can't imagine there's going to be... And obviously people's preference is always going to be fatigue.
You also have to bear in mind that things like the Olympics, when it is broadcast on terrestrial TV as well, may well push out other people's, the normal programmes that people would watch. So if you can't watch EastEnders at the normal time, then because you've got some sort of Olympics event on, what do you do to get your normal EastEnders fix? You then have to turn online or whatever catch-up service you want, and it drives kind of secondary usage that way.
Would they just move it to BBC Two? BBC won't shift EastEnders.
I don't have
EastEnders gets more
good. The plot will all be about EastEnders going to watch the Olympics.
I guess we're getting sidetracked here.
But I think you're right that there is, it's actually quite a difficult and it's an unprecedented event to have any real sense of what people will definitely do. So you've just got to plan for the worst, basically, haven't you?
Unknown unknowns, I suppose, isn't it, really?
It's all about having the infrastructure there, so it can be used if needed. We're only bringing bandwidth forward. It's not like we're, you know, putting in a large amount of bandwidth that we'll then have to decommission. It's only bringing something forward that would have been there in the very near future anyway.
Yeah. Does that mean, in terms of traffic management and traffic shaping, you're anticipating not needing to do that sort of really, really consumer unfriendly crunching of stuff?
I think the model we've got at the moment, and it's been in place for some time, refinements here and there on sort of a weekly and monthly basis, but pretty much the traffic management infrastructure we've got on the model has been in place some time now, and it works, and it's worked through past events. I mentioned the tennis that iOS 5 downloaded a while back. When we see these large events across the network, it caters for them well, and the good thing about that is the consumers and our customers, they don't notice it when these things happen. And I think ultimately that's what it's all about. I don't think the people who are giving us money for their broadband service really care about what we're doing.
No, as long as it works. Yeah.
And they don't notice it, and it doesn't affect the way that they want to use their broadband from day to day.
By building traffic management into the products that we actually sell, and being honest and upfront with customers and telling them this is what the package is, that means that the network, once it's all aggregated into the backhaul, it's very easy to make sure that stays within limits, because individual customers and events can only have so much effect, because individual customers, if they go crazy upstreaming, they may hit their limits. So there's always built-in tolerances there, whereby you limit the effect of any major events.
Well, one of the questions I think from Pete's listeners, I know they said users, but you don't get used. It was about, is there any demand for a service that is much more shaped, where it's sort of, this is tailored for video gamers, this is tailored for TV fans, this is tailored for people who don't want any of that? Is there a market for that, or is all you can eat more attractive?
I mean, our value product, which is the sort of entry level product, it kind of is that already to a certain degree.
To an extent, yeah.
If you are going to want to heavily use peer-to-peer applications, you're not going to get very far with that product, to be fair. The rate limiting that's on it, and it is well publicised on our website, it's nothing we're trying to hide. You'd be there days to download a significantly large file on that particular product. So it's already there. Whether or not people want it, I don't know. They kind of sign up for it. They perhaps don't know exactly what it is they're getting, but ultimately it works for them. And I think a lot of people who do come in at that level aren't heavy downloaders. They don't want these bandwidth-intensive applications. They don't want to download gigs and gigs and gigs of peer-to-peer each month. So I think it comes again to customer perception, and like you mentioned, they don't have a great concept of what uses how much. So again, to market something that, yes, this is heavily shaped, or you're talking about a sort of technology that means nothing to probably more than 90% of the base you're targeting your product at. So yes, there probably is a demand for it, but I don't think people necessarily know that's what they want.
I think it's important to know that we do sell high usage limit products, and we do sell bolt-ons to effectively remove the all of the traffic management. So the options are there for customers. If they want to go on that product, then we do offer that for sale. So it's all publicised on the website, and it is on the standard product offering. That's nothing special for us.
Does that fit with your perceptions of what people want rather than what people think they want? If you see what I mean.
I mean, I'd be interested in saying, if there was a product such as, you get guaranteed, if you're playing online, you get guaranteed, guaranteed 4.5, and, it won't break down. If it breaks down, then we'll give you a refund. But maybe there'd be a super demand for a product like that.
That's kind of what we angle our pro, used to be pro products, but pro add-on on. So the core of our products are everything is managed from sort of a disaster recovery viewpoint, but the rate limits in particular are quite prevalent on sort of our entry level product in particular, and not so much on sort of the one targeted at the moderate user, but on either of those two products, for another monthly surcharge, we'll apply what we call the pro add-on, and we'll put a traffic management profile across that product, keep the same usage allowances, whether it's, for argument's sake, 10 gig over the space of a month during the peak hours, but remove all that rate limiting. So again, even if you're only wanting to use very little each month, but when you do use it on live as an example, you want that to come down at line speed irrespective of the time of day, and you want that guarantee, then we offer that. And rather than have a product that does that, we kind of say you can keep the product that you're on and apply this add-on, an extra surcharge each month, and we'll lift those rate limits. So we'd like to think there's an option there for pretty much everyone.
Yeah, I think that's key, is to offer choices and to have enough differentials in the pricing and the functionality of the package. As long as you don't bamboozle them with choice, they just throw their hands up in the air and go somewhere else. So because if you give them three or four choices and they can maybe mix and match to a certain degree, then they'll understand that there'll be some package that'll be more suited to their usage. Also, I think what's really important, especially from our readers' point of view, is just transparency. The thing they probably hate most are the up-to adverts, which I think we'll see far less of next year. These ridiculously unachievable claims that people just get seduced by. Mm. So I think they understand the need for something like traffic management. I don't think they're naive or idealistic in that way, but they just want it to be a given or transparent upfront and clarified in advance. But I would still say that probably 90% of the public don't know what they want.
Well, that's it. I think, again, with the speed, certainly with our recent, especially the television adverts, we've tried to put a lot less emphasis on the up to speed. And I think
it'd be fascinating to go out there on Oxford Street and say,
a lot more on the option.
What do the words traffic management mean to you? And 90% of people on Oxford Street would be talking about double decker buses and route masters.
Traffic lights.
So.
I mean, it's interesting that the differentiating factors between different ISPs and things, they're quite hard to explain to end users. Apart from that, obviously, a figure is very obvious, like, you know, up to however many speed, and you can say, well, this one's twice as fast as this one. But that's pretty much, in terms of other things that people can use to differentiate between ISPs, I think it's quite tough to get that across in a very easy to understand way. I guess something such as, you know, we'll give you guaranteed on live. People don't know about 4.5 megabits, but, you know, if they just know that if I buy on live, then this is a good complementary product to have. Maybe you can just about understand that.
The main problem that I've found from my own customer support background is that there are too many factors that will reduce your speed that the ISP can't control. If a customer lives 5+ miles from the exchange, then unfortunately we cannot provide the headline speed, and that's one of the reasons why that's been deprioritised from our advertising. And we've always been careful so that we advertise, for example, if you go back 6 months, we have advertised up to 20 meg because that is an achievable download speed, whereas other providers choose to advertise speeds that they can control but don't provide.
In particular, there was always that differentiation of perhaps other providers that would provide the headline at 24 meg when in the real world, even if you sat on top of the exchange, it simply wasn't achievable. I think that's why even when the up-to advertising was there, it was a lot more prevalent. We kind of pitched it at 20 rather than 24, but it's difficult. Like the traffic management, it's difficult to educate people about. Certainly at the point of sale, as somebody runs through our sign-up journey, we'll use a quite broad kind of BT wholesale checker, which will give them an idea there and then of the speed before they've kind of committed to anything. So even on an up to 20 meg product, if they can only get 3, 4, maybe 5 meg, it will give them that kind of bracket. We try and take that a step further as well. It's 1-2 weeks into service, maybe.
It's around 2 weeks after the line's had sufficient time to stabilise and settle down.
That will, our systems will fire out an automated email. They'll say, right, you signed up on this day. We said you'd get speeds between these two values. You've now been with us a couple of weeks. Things have had time to settle down. This is the speed you get. And and that, at that point, I had the prompts to think, okay, that's nice, yeah. A bit more than I was estimated to get. Yeah. Or perhaps...
expectation management.
There might be a bit of a problem here, best get onto the support guys, which, either way, they have got a problem, it's not going as fast as it should do, we want to.
Yeah.
And that logic, it's about that expectation setting rather than...
What do you think of,
it's not as fast as it should be.
Sorry, what do you think of the ASA or Ofcom's decision to allow people to advertise up to speed if 10% of customers are receiving that? Because that was quite a big backlash from my readers who thought that was a complete cop-out.
I think that it's only fair that you should be able to advertise the speeds that you can achieve on the product that you offer, so long as you make it clear, as we do in sign-up, and even before you sign up, you can get a speed estimate that tells you, to the absolute best of our knowledge, the speed that we think that you'll get. Mm-hmm. And then we're always willing to investigate any problem that's apparent after provisioning to make sure that any speed problem is looked into and resolved to the best of our ability.
I think what frustrates readers is the difference between a headline grabbing speed, which is going to attract you from an advert, and then how big would that caveat be in an advert, for example?
Well, the alternative method that I would see is to say something like 80% of customers will achieve a certain speed, but then I think that will only serve to overcomplicate the message, and it'd be harder to understand than a simple up-to product and a specific estimate for every customer that chooses to sign up.
I think selling broadband services now based specifically focusing on headline speeds, whichever way you look at it, is kind of dangerous ground to be walking on. Yeah. You're always going to have a percentage of the base, whether using the old up to sort of 20 meg, 40 meg, whatever it might be, or perhaps the lower value that Ofcom's suggestions or proposals would give you. Either way, there's always going to be people who aren't getting that headline speed who are going to query. I think, again, the expectation setting before they've committed to anything, I think, is the safest, the most sensible way to go about that. Mm-hmm. I think I personally think that's the best approach.
Where does fibre fit into this? Because obviously Virgin Media would love there to be a very different way of measuring speeds, because they can say 97% of our customers get what we advertise. Where is that?
The same estimate that we can provide for our DSL base, there are similar tools that are applicable to the fibre. So again, where the wholesale might think a customer will get 20 meg headline seed speed rather than perhaps 40, it will tell them that. So there's that side of things is there. What we perhaps haven't got is the reactive, the post-sales kind of email that we put out. There's not as many tiers of profiling across perhaps the wholesale network for us to accurately say, you know, you are now getting this in throughput, this is what you're getting. And I think that's probably more to do with the relative infancy of the of fibre across wholesale network, rather than the fact that we don't want to do it. If we could do it and the tools were there, the systems would cater for it in exactly the same way as they would DSL. But the variance in speeds is a hell of a lot less dramatic with fibre compared to a DSL product. You can pretty much guarantee the vast majority of people, if there's not a physical fault with their line or their equipment or setup, are going to be satisfied with the speed they get from a fibre service, especially given the services that are available to them now. There's not a great deal that really requires the speeds, you know, 40 meg, 100 meg, it's excessive for the pretty much what anybody would use a residential internet connection for. So.
Although there is the argument that give them the speed and they'll find a usage for it.
Yeah, that's something I was just about to say.
They won't realise what they want until they're capable of getting it. So if you give them 300 meg, they'll then realise, my son can watch a film while I watch a film, or I can play a game while he plays a separate game. And they'll just...
Also on top of that, content providers will actually find ways of using it as well, not just the users. If you give everybody 100 meg, then content providers will actually say, okay, well, all these people have 100 megs, these are new applications to use it, like online.
And also high-definition TV, for instance, is impossible unless we get this stuff sorted out.
Which is true, and I think I'd be lying to you if I said that increasing a customer speed doesn't incur an increase in their usage. I think
statistics
that we have shown
innovation as well, that's the point. There'll be things that... There'll be new things to do online that will only really have been the desire to invent them will only come because people can actually consume them in a reliable way.
This is why that we are proactive with engaging with Openreach, the wholesale provider, to use the fibre network. We were one of the earlier providers to start provisioning customers on both fibre to the cabinet, and we're still trialling fibre to the premises.
Yeah.
And they are going to, Openreach are very soon going to be looking at new trials for both services. And again, we are proactively contacting customers to be able to take part in these trials and increase the speed.
Yeah.
And we're always open to any wholesale provider who can offer a great service and things like better speed, so that we can then offer those to the customers. So it's not a case of we're not looking to provide better speeds. We'll always provide the best speed possible to customers with the options that are available as to physically provision a line.
I think what's interesting is to the mentioning that the fibre trials, in particular the fibre to the premises trial, the two main sites, at least the last time I looked at it in any detail, were Milton Keynes and Bradwell Abbey for the fibre to the premises stuff. Both offering typically, you know, to go back to up to 200 meg speeds. What we found in particular, the DSL speeds across average in Milton Keynes were a lot lower than they are in Bradwell Abbey, just due to the geographical nature of the two towns. Milton Keynes, we had a reasonable, quite healthy take-up of the FTTP service. When you look at Bradwell Abbey, when I think the average was around about 12 meg that the customers were getting down on the ADSL2 service, we were really hard pushed to find even a single customer who would proactively go out of the way to want to take this 100 meg service. So again, I think at the moment, I agree that as things develop and as it becomes more widespread, the content will increase in quality and the bandwidth that's required to run it. But at the moment, I would pretty much say a 12 meg connection, that's some evidence that goes part way to say that that pretty much does what you need it to, certainly in the current climate.
Yeah.
I was going to say, does that tally with a super user perspective?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually get between 16 and 17 meg at home, and I'm hard pushed to fill that. It definitely needs. Yeah.
So if you look at usage compared to speed, you find that there's a fair uptake between, you know, the lowest broadband speeds on half meg up to around about 4 meg per second. But after that, between 4 meg and around 12 to 13 meg per second, the curve is actually very flat. So you can triple the speed from 4 to 12. The overall usage per month, there's very little difference in there. And it's only once you start exceeding the 12 megabit per second and you're then including all your fibre customers that you then really see the speeds, sort of your total usage per month pick up again. So that goes back to questions, do customers know what they want?
Yeah.
Or is it that once you've got four, you can stream the iPlayer and that sort of thing, but you can't do a load of other stuff, and so you try it once and then they won't bring it?
Well, we probably see higher variations in the amount of streaming done based on the geographic area. For instance, London, they stream approximately 25% more than the average for the UK. And that's probably a higher increase than the amount of usage, basically going difference between 4 meg and 12 meg. So there's a lot of different factors that will change exactly how much people use.
Does that mean, in a sense, all the stuff about hardware, increased rollout of high-speed broadband, from your point of view, there isn't a huge commercial rush? You don't, that people aren't clamouring for this stuff right now and saying they're going to give you a fortune to buy?
Well, I think I can just pull that back to Bob's point. It's very much based on the current speed customers achieve. Mm. If it's an area like Milton Keynes, where people are struggling with the speeds, then there is a high uptake. If you go to the areas where the speeds are already acceptable, then people aren't increasing their speed just for the sake of it. Even if it's offered on a trial basis to them, the uptake is still low.
Okay. Does that fit?
Yeah, I would concur. I think it's a strong defence of the notion that people are getting the speeds that at the moment they're happy with or that they're satisfied with. But I do really, really strongly believe that people often don't know what they want until they're presented with it.
Okay.
In the same way that who would have thought that an iPad would be the sort of thing we would want 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or even until you imagine the possibility of something, it's very difficult to know that your life's lacking it until you're shown the benefit.
Yeah.
And so in 10 years' time, the notion that we'll be satisfied with 24 meg, I think, will be pretty seem medieval.
I think the current uptake of the fibre people are probably the more tech-savvy people who know that they want fibre and are therefore going to use it more, which is reflected in the graphs that you said. Once they get over that amount and they get to, they start using more. But the tech-savvy people of today, well, everyone is going to be at that point in a few years' time.
I also think cost is a massive issue,
Yeah.
People are... We're heading for 10 years of doom and gloom. It's going to be awful. The next 10 years is going to be terrible. And I just don't think people are going to have much money to splash around on things they might perceive to be luxuries.
Yeah.
You know, is the broadband a human right? Discuss.
Is there, just before we do discuss that, is there a danger that if...
Feel free to bring it in.
That if fibre does start becoming mainstream and applications do start taking advantage of this bandwidth, we get a kind of us and them, fast and slow type of network where you've got people still struggling away on half a meg versus people doing HD streaming. Is it kind of comparable to sort of the... dial-up versus broadband when that first came along?
Well, I think that we've always had some sort of divide in speeds. The rural divide has always been a contention for the last few years. But then you'll see other niche providers like Rutland Telecom, who, assisted by Openreach, can actually produce fibre to the cabinet service where it's in small areas that otherwise a wholesale provider wouldn't be able to justify on the basis of cost. So I think that instead of it saying it's kind of an us and them, it's a case of those who do want the faster services can achieve them, and they can create their own company to enable them to do that.
I think ultimately it's not in content providers' interests either to kind of alienate perhaps those who can't get higher speed services. I think as long as there is a service there and both ends are being catered for, then there's always going to be a bit of angst, I suppose, from those who can't perhaps get what Uncle Joe gets in the next town along. But I can see it being like that for some time until it's consistent speed.
I guess I was wondering if there could be a risk that certain people are completely excluded from certain services. Are there still people on that?
I suppose we do have people on that, but they use it or not, I'm not entirely sure. But yes, we've still got a dial-up base. It's dwindling. It's pretty static. We probably don't take any sign-ups on dial-up anymore. It's strictly broadband-based.
We still get readers in. Yeah, we use dial-up in mountainous regions of Wales, for example.
But there's no alternative.
Absolutely, or satellite broadband, which is...
But presumably they can't access streaming services or...
Yeah, I mean,
they
write
struggle
to us,
through it, I guess.
They write to us and say, well, it's fantastic that you've given us a new guide on BBC iPlayer, but unfortunately I'm incapable of using it. But of course, this comes back to the original argument. If we'd had 10 years of dial-up, then we wouldn't have had the iPlayer with the success of YouTube or the success of Lovefilm.
Yeah.
And so extra speed will drive innovative online projects.
And I think we certainly see people on DSL products now who are... and it'll be a significant amount of people with sub 4 meg connections. And a HD iPlayer stream is not going to work on anything below 4 meg.
No.
Even a sort of moderate stream on iPlayer for those unlucky to still be getting sort of half meg on a re-adaptive service, it's not going to work. So, yeah, absolutely, there are people with broadband who can't make use of some of the existing services that are out there. And I think, certainly, whilst we're still relying on ADSL 1 and ADSL 2 technology, that's unfortunately going to be the case, I think.
Well, where does that put us in terms of the net neutrality debate? Because obviously offering services is an easier competition if you're able to say, well, this is the bit that we put this service down and this is the bit that we don't. Is that a debate that only really happens because we haven't got enough capacity and we're building it, so we're going to get over it?
I think that's more geared towards the infrastructure side of things. It's not as if those services were available to people and now they're not,
exactly,
as a result of what somebody's done. It's early, I think, and as time goes by, more and more people will be in a position where they can take advantage of that content rather than the reverse.
Mm. Does that fit?
Yeah, I mean, originally, a 512K connection was the best that some people could get. And since then, people on those lines can now probably get 4 meg, and people who are much further out that couldn't get it at all can now get a 512K connection. I think all the content providers are doing a pretty good job of of differentiating their content for people with fast connections and slow connections. iPlayer do various streams, YouTube do various bitrate streams. I think eventually everyone's going to be on broadband, and everybody, wherever they are in the country, will be able to get a reasonable connection. So you've got to work to what's the common denominator now. There are going to be people that are going to be excluded. There are people who are still on dial-up. They're not going to go on broadband anytime until the technology actually changes to let them get on broadband. But that's coming.
Or there's the political will to...
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know, but there's never going to be the political will to tunnel through granite to get to one farmhouse in Wales.
But you wouldn't exclude that farmhouse from electricity or from running water.
Well, I mean, but there are plenty of flat houses that aren't on the national grid, aren't on mains gas, aren't on... And
but they can still access the utilities in a different way, can't
yes,
they?
Yeah, exactly. But that's where satellite broadband and that sort of thing fits in.
Then maybe that needs to be subsidised.
Yeah.
The question is, of course, should broadband be a subsidised utility in the same way that electricity is? Or should it be a given that everybody should have...
Yeah,
I think that's access to it. That's the view the government's starting to take, putting all of their services online.
If
their services are online, they're expecting people to have it.
Well, what's interesting is that there's a resistant core of about 20% of the population who just do not want to go online.
Yeah.
And if they're not going by now, which is what we can do, wait till they die off, and then which is what's going to happen.
Well, yeah.
Because there's nobody born now who's not going to see the internet as an integral part of their life. Really, I can't really see that. Or certainly how they might not use it that frequently, but they'll see the benefits of it.
Yeah. And ironically, one of the departments that led this was DEFRA, so you've got rural hill farmers being forced to fill in forms with no broadband. But never mind. Does that fit in from your point of view, though, that people is what's driving customer growth now poaching off other people rather than recruiting that resistant 20%?
Yes, to answer that question.
it's
very similar to the mobile telephony market. I think we're pretty much in a switches market rather than getting these the sort of elite few that are reluctant to take up the service. I don't have specific figures. I'm not that heavily involved with sort of the sales and the customer take up side of things, but I would imagine that a very, very large percentage of the customers that we acquire will be migrations from other providers, as opposed to, or perhaps home movers to a certain degree, but nonetheless people who have had a broadband service, be it with us or somebody else, prior to approaching us, rather than somebody who's never.
And how do you differentiate what you do versus what other people do? Is cost always going to be the single biggest factor, or is... I'm not going to say Yorkshire.
I said we like to target ourselves as being very value driven, not necessarily cheap but good value, and our support avenues and the way that we help customers, and we're quite active across the community, vocal, like to be out there, we like to talk with the base that we've got. I think that's kind of what we focus on quite a lot, and yes, there is the sort of entry level cost perspective, but like Ben said on a few occasions before, for those perhaps power users who want the higher speeds, they want the higher bandwidth allowances, they don't want any traffic management, we cater for that perfectly well at the same time. It's just perhaps we don't plaster that over our mainstream television adverts, because a lot of the custom we do get is from the entry level who are looking for value. Again, going back to the economic climate at the moment, it's a lot of people are just looking at headline price, and that's kind of what they're going for.
Just going back to the topic of people running the services on top of your network and stuff. So, I mean, one thing that, it happens in a lot of industries, VoIP and, streaming music and stuff like that, but say, so certainly in mobile industry is one example where, so Orange have a service called UMA whereby you boot your calls, your text messages, and most of your data traffic already goes over Wi-Fi. O2 are launching something soon, I believe, and I'm sure the other networks are also doing something similar. In the US, they've got something where it's like $19 a month and you use UMA. Most of your calls, texts and stuff are routed over your home broadband connection. So the kind of thing I'm kind of wondering from your point of view is, so my relationship is with my mobile phone provider, £35 a month, whatever. I'm paying that money to them, but they're actually doing very little. It's all going over your landline connection, of which you're probably getting, £8 or £9 a month or something. So from your point of view, how do you feel about that in terms of your network's pretty much doing all of the work, yet someone else is making all the money? Do you kind of see, do you kind of feel maybe that's falling to kind of a dumb, well, not, I don't want to say dumb pipe, but, or do you kind of see, do you think you'd have to go for the related services such as that in order to make the margins and to make the money?
I think irrespective of what's using the traffic, the traffic is still travelling across our network, and we're kind of still, we're still being paid for the provision of that service. So with it being sort of a mobile service or UMA, I don't think it particularly matters to somebody perhaps with their Xbox plugged into their room and using the similar amount of traffic doing that.
Right.
I mean, we certainly wouldn't discriminate in any way. I've dealt with customers using UMA before and VoIP services and things like that, whether provided by us or not, are things that we'll proactively manage, so they are given a high priority across the network. Which is certainly good, again, going back to the thought that people just want something that works. If, for example, you have perhaps got young kids in the house and they're running peer-to-peer apps, saturating the bandwidth, the way that our network will work, unless you pay to have these sort of rate limits and the management removed, is you try and make a VoIP call, you try and make a UMA call, that's going to work, whether the bandwidth's being saturated by these higher bandwidth applications or not. Versus perhaps somebody you might go for an all-you-can-eat provider doing exactly the same thing. They try and make a UMA call, try and make a VoIP call. It's not going to work because everything's kind of battling for dominance over the connections. So I think our traffic management helps a lot there with regards to whether or not we care what's generating that traffic. The moment, to a certain degree, I don't think we do.
I think the point I was trying to make is, okay, so you're paying your £40 a month to someone else, and you guys are making your £10 a month off the landline connection or whatever. Do you kind of see that as not an ethical one, but kind of a, I mean, do you feel like, say, companies such as Orange, because they're providing home broadband and the mobile service, you know, it doesn't matter which network to them it goes over. But home broadband's probably better because they make better, you know, it's quite cheap to buy. But in terms of someone else is making a lot of money off essentially just people piggybacking on your network,
I can kind of see what you're saying. I don't, again, with it just being traffic, it's different traffic to some other stuff that goes across the network, but I don't think it doesn't bother us too much. Obviously, I suppose we could see it as an opportunity. Orange have the mobile telephony networks over to. It's something that obviously we could, if we chose to, look at branching out to. It isn't something we do at the moment. Whether or not they're using one of our broadband connections, I guess we'd rather they did that than use one of Virgin's or Sky's.
BT with Vision and Sky with Anytime Plus and that sort of thing have clearly taken the view that the way to make money off broadband is to sell people extra stuff over the top of it. Is that just the nature of a market that is at risk of becoming even more commoditised than it is already?
I think so. Obviously, the more the dual play services, especially triple play services, a lot of people are looking at. I think it, again, probably goes back to the economic climate, the headline prices, and things like that. Try to get everything into one basket. I know even ourselves, we've got a lot more focus on dual play as opposed to perhaps what we have done in the past with standalone broadband services. You'll find even visiting our website, a lot of it will be it's your landline and it's your broadband. I think at the moment we haven't really got we're not extending into any sort of mobile or even TV propositions at the moment. It's not to say that we won't do in the future, but I think if you can get a customer with a landline that's sort of owned and provided by you and the broadband service, then it's better to do that than have perhaps that landline with one provider, the broadband with another. It's that's certainly, I think, what we'd be aiming for.
I'm not sure I've got anything to add to that, really. Having that work in the industry itself, so we ran a poll recently on our Facebook page asking readers how often they switched broadband provider. And that was really interesting. Hardly any, really. I mean, fewer than 10 or 20% switched in the last 5 years. So it seems to be a real...
There's a perception that it's a hassle as well.
certainly there's no question about that, especially everything with the Mac, the code that you had to receive, and there was a lot of that was perceived to be incredibly laborious and time-consuming to actually go through that whole process. But also there seems to me a big default mentality here, which is the first one you get to, you tend to stick with. A bit like changing bank. You know, changing bank is one of the biggest headaches you can go through. Anyone who's done it, Jesus, you know, it's an absolute nightmare. Obviously, changing callback providers are quite as bad as that, but the perception might be that it is. Have you found that tricky to overcome?
I think there's probably an element of it's not broken, don't fix it as well. It's especially perhaps for the non
which is the problem that TalkTalk had, isn't it? Is that it was broke, so loads of people left.
So I think there is that, and I think the only other things at the moment, or the main things that are driving somebody to want to switch would be, coming back to the headline price again, and perhaps another one is when somebody moves house. I think they probably see the hassle of needing to set up a new line, get the broadband back up and running. It's kind of, it's enough hassle as it is, so why not have a shop around?
Have you done any research about how important that is as a determining factor in people deciding where to move? I'm in a process of looking for a new house at the moment, and not a single estate agent I've spoken to knows the broadband providers in that particular area.
Although it's now one of the sort of standard fields on Rightmove.
So, that's a sign. I'm dealing with some logical estate agents who just don't even know what zone a particular area is. They don't know what broadband.
I think it's more of an issue in rural areas. I'm sorry, you said zone, so I'm assuming you're in London.
Yeah, obviously, yes. So it's London-ish. But yeah, that surprised me, because I just thought that would be... I don't know, I mean, have you finding more research of that important?
Not first hand, I've not seen anything particularly.
There is anecdotal evidence that it is affecting house prices from estate agents.
But it's not going to be up there with schools or.
No, although there's. Have you come across Hyperoptic? It's the guys who set up the broadband have now got a new version, and they've been retrofitting very high-speed broadband connections into blocks of flats.
Yes, they're the ones doing 100... They're just the one in London, haven't they?
Yes, they've done a couple now, and they're finding that landlords have found a real sort of correlation between retaining tenants and selling houses if you can say, we've got a 1 gig connection or whatever it is. And no one's actually using it, of course, but that's not the point. In terms of future-proofing, then it's...
Yeah, it's a good point. Really good point, especially with tech-savvy metropolitan types.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, this. I think the first blocks they've done are in sort of Battersea, Clapham kind of thing, where you get sort of young professionals.
Yeah, it's going to be crucial.
One of the major concerns about me moving into where I live now is how far away from the exchange am I going to be?
Yeah. Which is quite detailed.
Yeah.
How long is the cable?
Yeah.
Anything else?
Is there anything else on the agenda?
No, that's the only reason why I'm asking.
Go on, Gary.
No, what I was going to say was I think what's really interesting is that there isn't, from my perspective, a lot of what I write about, sort of 530 million quid going into broadband rollout, that actually the customer is not saying, I want that doubled, I want more money spent on this. And it makes you wonder where the reality is in this, and whether it's investing for the future, and we're going to be wishing we'd spent more as a nation, or whether actually you guys are being much more sort of realistic about it.
You see a fair
time will tell.
But it hasn't held South Korea back, has it? They're not suffering because they've got the fastest broadband speeds.
But
they've spent a lot of money on it, obviously. Clearly,
what's also interesting though is a lot of people cutting back. Sort of the average broadband speed in Korea is actually 12 meg.
Really?
There are lots of different versions of that number, but it's not 100, is the point. And a huge number of people that signed up for 100 and then thought, actually, I don't need it. Because it was quite expensive.
But from a business point of view, where you will need that kind of speed, perhaps, it's going to the infrastructure of hopefully increase employment and.
I mean, I have to say, I'm on your side.
But that's an interesting point that if people are signing up and have. I suppose it's sort of the potential they could use. And until they're shown how to...
Things like working from home, you know, having the high-speed VPN connection to the office, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Opening, you know, sometimes you want to open up 100 megabyte files to analyze and do this and that. I guess that's something which hasn't... It's probably not commonly used that much now, but perhaps in the future will be, and having that infrastructure there would be really...
I mean, and lovely as the coffee was, there is no reason not to have done this as a video conference.
Absolutely.
But actually, all our respective broadband connections would probably have made it a struggle.
Yeah.
We can connect to New York on HD1. It's actually...
So if you guys have gone to New York...
Is there a danger that if something like a new Freeview box comes out, I know we've got UView coming out next year, but if all new Freeview boxes have an Ethernet socket and are dependent on a net connection to live, that consumers are going to have to plumb their set-top boxes and TVs into the net, is that likely to have a big impact?
I don't think it'll ever be a necessity for somebody to do that, and well, certainly not in the imminent future. Obviously there are internet capable TVs now that do very similar things. I'd imagine there probably are Freeview boxes that do the same sort of on-demand content and things like that. I think the driving streaming is going to be more an amalgamation of the various different services and technologies that we're expecting over the coming years, rather than just one key provider or one key technology. I think, like so UView, a lot of people talk about it. I think, yes, it is going to drive a lot of traffic and perhaps an increase in bandwidth, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, UView that's going to blow up everyone's network. And
also, as a huge number of TVs have iPlayer built in, then actually whether UView comes on stream or not, then you're either streaming or you're not, kind of thing. So it's not going to be, I don't think it's quite going to be the game changer that it would have been if they'd have launched it when they should have done.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be sort of the net combination of all of these services and the increase in smartphone tablet usage and more devices sort of tapping into that content rather than your conventional desktop computers and laptops.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if there's going to be some product that appears out of thin air.
If you look at the net figures for Netflix in America, actually more than 50% of their streaming actually goes to gaming consoles, Xbox, PS3 and Wii. So it's the actual development of applications so that you can take a content provider can deliver their content to existing hardware. That's driving much more bandwidth than newly created hardware.
Mm. Although, I mean, obviously that will evolve in the sense that long term, the concept of a console is probably going to disappear. It's going to be stuff that's a combination of built into whatever you're watching on and cloud-based. So it's sort of, in a sense, retrofitting what we've got is just how these things will inevitably work for now, isn't it?
Well, the equipment that people have as pretty much standard in their living room is capable of doing all their streaming and all their gaming.
Exactly.
So I don't think that... The question was about individual set-top boxes with an Ethernet connection. I really don't think that's going to be a particularly big game changer. And we are looking at things like the launch of potentially Apple TV at some point in the future. I don't think that's going to be a massive change in the way that people actually have the content delivered to the TV. People are already streaming a huge amount on their existing hardware.
Do you see eventually TV... But I mean, that's what people talk about, analog switch off and all that, and the theoretical version is digital switch off. Is that, can you imagine that ever happening?
Well, if you look at the things like the we have a limited electromagnetic spectrum, things like with the 4G rollout, then that's causing problems. So I think that a complete digital switch off probably won't happen. If you look at things like the remote areas, the people in the farmhouse on the side of a hill, then they... Yeah. Depending on the technology for broadband, they may never be able to have all of their content delivered over their internet connection. So I think that you won't see a digital switch off unless it was replaced with something like satellite, which has universal coverage without any exceptions.
But you're certainly going to see a huge number of people watching less and less on the sort of conventional broadcast.
I don't think it will happen soon. I think it will come very close to happening. Yeah. If it doesn't happen at some point.
Yeah.
Sooner than we think, maybe.
But
not in the next couple of years.
That's the general consensus on what's going to happen with going back to net neutrality. In America, the laws are very close to being sealed, I think, aren't they? And finalised. I just wonder if anyone's got any predictions as to what's going to happen and where that's going to leave the industry.
Well, with the network neutrality is we apply it in a form of very well publicised traffic management so people can get what they pay for. And I think that that model is only going to increase across the industry, because the latest fibre connections, or on the latest trial for fibre connections, you're looking at a few hundred megabits to your property. If you have multiple customers using that, or with those sort of connections available to them, it's very, very easy to completely saturate your backhaul network. If you have a non-traffic managed network, then anyone trying to make a phone call, stream, TV, play online gaming, those services simply stop working. Mm. Whereas if you employ traffic management, that allows you to correctly prioritise the highest priority.
But what happens if laws are actually imposed upon you to cement certain net neutrality policies that you sort of philosophically disagree with?
Well, if the laws were extrapolated from current Ofcom guidelines, then it would be a simple case of the traffic management must be easy to access for the consumer, so that before they purchase the product, and that's something that we do completely support, and we do actively encourage with our customers throughout the sign-up process. It's all there.
And also, if you've got the capacity, then network neutrality ceases to be an issue, basically.
I think if laws were imposed, I don't particularly think they will be anytime soon in this country. But if it was to happen, I don't think any guidelines would be drawn up that would be prohibitive or cause problems for ISPs. We're not in a massively dissimilar position to the vast majority of other ISPs who are providing the service. And if laws were brought into play that would essentially break customers' use of the service or how they go about things, I can't see that happening. If anything, it would be a very gradual thing, perhaps with content, maybe providers looking for offering more content-based services and perhaps caching content locally on their network and offering the content themselves, as opposed to it sort of just being fed through their backhaul bandwidth. That's perhaps an avenue that people go down. I could see that happening.
Yeah. I think with the current raft of net neutrality rules, it's mainly content provider specific. So you're not prioritising one content provider over another, rather than in terms of managing the traffic, you're not prioritising one protocol over another. Because actually prioritising protocols makes sense, but prioritising Google over someone else for a financial reward does.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. On which happy note, Is there anything anyone would like to add?
Well, I'd say it'd be interesting over the next 5-10 years to see what people do with all these faster connections, and if it's there, people will build all kinds of weird stuff. Like I've seen things like a remote control vacuum cleaner which you operate over Wi-Fi and it's got a camera on the front, you can drive it around using a smartphone.
Just to interrupt you, Alex, it's reasonably relevant to that point that you make. On the World IPv6 Day, customers set up a IPv6 cat feeder, which I think is still online. Come the end of that day, it was publicised on our blog. I think it's a cat, the poor thing. A mountain of cat food by this people who are sat there clicking the button and they're delivering cat food.
It'll be that sort of thing that drives demand for 100 meg.
Because humans can't think of a use for it, so the cat is fine.
I don't think there's a huge commercial market for IPv6 cat feeders. You never know.
Give it time.
iCat.
Oh, God. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think it's a really interesting debate, it's actually a lot of the stuff that we get into a lather about, whether it's net neutrality or capacity or shaping and all that, is actually a much more reasonable conversation that you can have rather than get very worked up about.
I think it means different things to different people. Ultimately, I don't think there's a one particular angle you can.
And you do get some people very evangelical about preserving certain sort of neutrality, and while you have some sympathy with it, they can become quite radicalised
and really boring.
Which is a separate issue.
Really boring, yeah. Lovely, thank you very much.
there you have it. Thanks very much to Matt Warman for chairing, and to Daniel, Ken, Ben, Bob and Barry for a lively debate.
Thanks too to our listeners for supplying the questions.
And to Natalie and the team at Kazoo for putting on the PlusNet Industry Insight session.
Yep, thanks to all of you. And to find out more and for our interviews with the attendees, go to frequencycast.co.uk/PlusNet.
Thanks for listening to our recording of the PlusNet Insight session. And again, apologies for the quality of the audio recorded on the day. If this is your first time listening to Frequency Cast, perhaps give our main show a listen. Here's a sample of what we do.
What have you got there?
This is the hottest bit of kit.
Usually the station ham radio is operated by those astronauts that stay on station several months at a time.
Have the top-up TV anytime box. We are absolutely disgusted with the service.
We're measuring Carl's EEG. His retention level was in sort of the bottom third.
I think he's a lost cause, in all honesty.
And in breaking news, it looks like a new Freeview HD channel will be with us soon.
This year's European Podcast Award 2010.
The winner for the non-profit is Frequency Cast.
After 200 yards, turn right.
We've just officially been given the world record for the lightest touchscreen mobile phone in the world.
I can send a text to Frequency Cast for you.
That's true, I can now control my TV from my iPhone.
Now, it's a darkened room you live in, isn't it, normally?
Hi there, I'm Susie Perry from The Gadget Show, listening to Frequency Cast.
Each show we cover the latest in TV and tech news, as well as looking at new products and services and answering listeners' emails. Our shows are free and you can get new shows automatically from iTunes or your favourite podcatcher. Keep your ears open for our next tantalising take on technology at www.frequencycast.co.uk.
Frequency Cast. Special report. Shutdown complete.